So we've looked at the example Maharaj Yudhisthira, the different qualifications required for a leader, a Krishna conscious leader of society. We looked at Vedic astronomical calculations and how they apply to modern Western audience, and also how they apply to devotees. We evaluated the Duru's dealings with the Pandavas when not disclosing the news of the annihilation of the other dynasty, and compared that with his dealings with Dhritarashtra when awakening him from his slumber of disease and old age. So what we're actually going to finish off chapter 13 today, and we'll be looking at particularly the attitude of renunciation as shown by Dhritarashtra, and some of the general principles we can learn from Dhritarashtra's practice of yoga and Gandhari's entering the funeral pyre. And then we're also going to look at certain statements which reflect Srila Prabhupada's mood and mission. So chapter 13 just a recap. Chapter 13, Vidura returns to Hastinapur after learning from Maitreya Muni. Vidura preaches to Dhritarashtra, who later leaves with his wife Gandhari and Vidura. Radha Muni appears and instructs Yudhisthira to take shelter of the Supreme Personality of Godhead Krishna, and hints that the Lord's pastimes on this planet may be coming to an end. And finally he explains that Dhritarashtra, after going to the Ganges, will give up his body while performing mystic yoga. So now, in the previous chapter also, we've covered many of the Purva Svadvaya questions. We've had a look at those. There are from 6 to 13, I think it is, in this chapter. 6 to 16. There's about 10 questions still to be answered. Plus, in this chapter, we also look at the open book essay question 1. That comes up under that first topic of Dhritarashtra's renunciation. So looking at verse 35, let's look at statements which discuss Dhritarashtra's renunciation. What would be, what's the main point? Who can say what is the main point that we should draw, perhaps from Srila Prabhupada's purport? Main principle that Srila Prabhupada brings up in this connection. what's that? Chapter 13, text number 30. What's that?
unless one is convinced of a better life after renunciation of the present life, one can't speak to the renounced order of life simply by artificial dresses hanging off of.
Exactly. Yeah, that's exactly right. Yeah. Yep, that's exactly what I would have put. So that, you know, that is in the essay questions, discuss the proper attitude to renunciation is exemplified Dhritarashtra. So there's only the one real statement there. If you can add to that in a 250-word essay, it's not very difficult, really, that one. But it's a very important point. You know, it's like this morning. This morning's verse in the Bhagavatam that it describes avoiding association with materialistic persons or the opposite sex if they're, you know, materialistic. Avoiding association with the opposite sex for you know, material reasons, that is very, very dangerous. So of course that's just not possible to do for people who don't have a higher taste or something better to go to. It's Prabhupada actually describes there was one person who actually, that he knew, who gave up, he was a very wealthy person, gave up his family, basically, you know, lived as a renounced person in Vrindavan. And Prabhupada said it was so difficult for him, he died. So difficult to, you know, because he had no ability like the Goswamis. The Goswamis, of course, were absorbed in Radha Bhava or Gopi Bhava, but he had no Gopi Bhava. So, you know, he was basically a person on the material platform that went straight, you know, even living in Vrindavan, no realization of devotional service, and really just to imitate or to try and live a renounced life. He literally died from the fact that it was just too hard for him to live in that circumstance. So you don't, it doesn't get more difficult than that, that you just can't live. So any questions or comments on that? It's an important point, a simple point, so that can be elaborated on.
An example in Nectar Devotion, Prabhupada, whatever, Seaman, I think he was able to renounce, I think, Lal Babu.
Lal Babu?
Yeah. A wealthy man from Calcutta who renounced and he did door to door begging.
Right.
And he was given as an example of actual renunciation where he could do.
He could?
He could, yeah.
Right. Because he came to the devotional platform, didn't he?
Yeah. Because he was showing humility, I think, the context of humility.
Right, yeah.
So, when he went to his enemies, he had to go and beg.
Yeah. So, you know, if the person's able to relish that platform of spiritual life, they've got, you know, can taste something better, as Prabhupada says it. You know, they're convinced of a better life after renunciation of the present one. That means, you know, now, and of course after death also, they're just convinced that, okay, there's some difficulties now, I'm in the last stages of my life, and then I'm going back to Godhead. You're really convinced, you'll stick it out, but without the proper realization, the difficulties seem to go on forever without any end result.
So this question has two parts. Is it like half smart, half smart?
Which one?
What was the first question? To you?
The first one?
Yeah.
Discuss the proper attitude to renunciation as exemplified by Dhritarashtra. How is this relevant for you and your ashram? Yeah. So, five marks for each. Yeah. All of the questions are 5 marks for each of the 2 points asked for, except for question 4A, the first part carries 7, the next part 3. That means explain the principles of shyness and gender separation. There's 7 marks for there, and 3 to then just present that to a modern Western audience. And in part B, question 4B, if you choose to do that, comparing Vidura's dealings with the Pandavas with Dhritarashtra, 4 points for that, and making the comparison, and 6 points for, you know, actually identifying the principles of behaviour, you know, Vidura's behaviour. For 4B?
4A.
4A, yeah, 7 for the first part, so to explain the principles of shyness and etc., and 3 parts to appropriately present it to a modern Western audience.
Okay.
Yeah. And then 4B is 4 points for the first part of comparing Vidura's dealings with the Pandavas and with Dhritarashtra with reference to those verses in chapter 13, and the 6 points for actually identifying the appropriate general principles from Vidura's behaviour. Yeah, 6 points if you actually identify them properly, and then by comparing, 4 points.
You can select only one.
Yeah, you only do one of those. You either do 4A or 4B. So, at this stage, so at this stage we've actually covered all of the open book assessment questions in one of our classes, and but later on we can come back, and if you have any questions on any of those, we'll have a look at that a little bit later in the class. Yeah. Still with Dhritarashtra and Gandhari as well. Okay. We're looking at Dhritarashtra's practice of yoga. Now, in your handbooks, I think it's, say, verses 53 to 57, is it? Discuss general principles we can learn from Dhritarashtra's practice of yoga. Do you have that at all?
Yeah, 53 to 57.
From what I've read, it should be 53 to 59. I don't know why they've stopped at 57. Because in 58 we see that, you know, because we're discussing Gandhari as well, and that begins from 58. While outside observing her husband who will burn in the fire of mystic power along with his thatched cottage, his chaste wife will enter the fire of rapt attention. And then there's more on, you know, important points discussed in verse 59 as well. So I would probably change that in your books to 53 to 59. Yeah. To be able to cover the points, all of the points that are there. And there was another one I thought was... If you see anyone else who's... then now where it says select statements from verses 13, chapter 13, verses 36 to 37, again, which reflect Prabhupada's mood and mission. From memory, I think that had to be adjusted as well. What have you got, 36 to 37? I think it should be 35.
Morning mission, this is the morning mission, right?
Yes.
Morning mission is 35, it's not written for the given at the present moment.
Yes, select statements from verses 36 to 37 and 47 to 48 which reflect Prabhupada's mood and mission. Right. See, even that statement that we just looked at in verse 35, that unless one is convinced of a better life after renunciation of the present life, one cannot stick to the renounced order of life simply by artificial dress or staying out of the home. To me, that is quite a strong reflection of, you know, ISKCON's mood of, you know, giving people an opportunity to experience a higher taste in this life, and also you know, that strong understanding of the goal of life, you know, going back to the spiritual world, developing love of God. To me, you know, Prabhupada's mood and mission begins, you know, in verse 35 as well. You know, I would actually include that in there. if we look at verse 36, I don't think there's anything there. Do you know what I mean? Verse 36 says, first he slowly pacified his mind and intelligence, wiping away his tears and thinking the feet of his master Dhritarashtra, began to reply to Maharaj Yudhisthira. But there's no real mood or mission statements there. So to me, I think it's an editorial mistake, and they must have meant 35 to 37.
Cheated by those great souls.
Yes, that's part of it. That is we're looking at Srila Prabhupada's preaching mood, and here this sometimes the occasion that one needs to cheat. Or one appears to be cheating for the benefit of others, you know, in the preaching work. Yeah. So, in verse 37, Srila Prabhupada discusses that. So we'll come back to that. But I was just while I was pointing out a few editorial things that we needed to do, I thought I'd bring it up. But we'll stay on the subject of Dhritarashtra, 53 to 59. What we can learn from Dhritarashtra's practice of yoga, and then right at the last couple of verses, Gandhari's entry in the funeral pyre. Starting from verse 53, I'm just going to quickly mention a few points, and before I go to the next verse, if someone would like to, you know, comment on any more on that particular verse, then do so. But some of the important things that we see is that it's a mechanical way to control the senses. The yoga system that Dhritarashtra is practicing to control the senses and the mind, and, you know, to divert them from matter to the spirit. It's a mechanical way of doing yoga, and the yoga is to divert from matter to spirit. Also in that purport, it describes it, a lot of the things that Dhritarashtra are doing, some of them were preliminary processes. You know, sitting postures, meditation, spiritual thoughts, manipulation of air passing within the body, gradual situation in trance, facing the absolute person, Paramatma, because many of the activities leading up to when a yogi is actually able to get you to realize the Paramatma feature of the Lord are really preliminary activities. You consider someone a mature, successful yogi when they've actually realized the Paramatma feature. That's what, for them, really, the proper goal is achieved then. So So many people these days, of course, they consider that if they're just doing the asanas, you know, they're doing some advanced yoga technique. A lot of them, you know, for a long time, even in meditation, even in the beginnings of trance, are really preliminary. They haven't reached the goal. And it comes up again in verse 54. Another thing in still on verse 53, that a lot of so-called yogis and yogi systems manifest some magical feats, and that ignorant persons are really attracted by such false things. Because they don't know the purpose of the yoga. They think that the yoga system is a cheap healing process for the diseases in the body, you know, because they don't know the goal of yoga. If they get a little relaxed, you know, the blocked nose becomes cleared, something, you know, they feel that yes, this is very good. So they can so because they're expecting something else, something cheap, then they're really easily cheated, you know, by anything out of the ordinary. Another thing, of course, there, Prabhupada mentioned that, you know, foolish man, they want something cheap, and they don't want to practice any regulative principles. So they have no real understanding of what yoga is, and but if they hear of any different results that may be there through yoga, they'll want them very cheaply without really doing anything. They can put a bit of money over the counter and, you know, get some result without actually having to do any difficult work, then they'll be happy. So Srila Prabhupada begins to point out, of course, in the same purport still, that he says a lot in this purport, there's a lot of nice points that so they're the misconception. What is the real process? It's the yoga system, the process of learning to forget basically what we've knowledge we've acquired in the struggle for existence. So then he points out what it actually is. And then, in order, knowing what the real goal of yoga is, how do you get success? Not cheaply, but following what Dhritarashtra did. And of course, that's the whole question. You know, what can we learn from Dhritarashtra? Is that he got success because he went to, he seated himself in a sanctified place and was concentrating upon one objective, namely the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Now, that's coming up in verse 34. And so as Prabhupada explains, that because all his senses are engaged in the service of the Lord, you know, this process helps the devotee to free themselves from the contaminations of material modes of nature. So there in verse 54, Prabhupada points out the real goal of yoga and how Dhritarashtra did achieve that compared to... he gives other things that, you know, one who surrendered himself at the lotus feet of the Lord, Hari, can transcend the modes of material nature and be fixed. So, you know, he's pointing out that in the yoga system, one actually has to engage their senses in the service of the Supreme Lord, and to be fixed in that, there must be surrender. Otherwise, you know, one will not be fixed. And if one is surrendered, then yes, one can transcend the modes of material nature. So Prabhupada is really pointing out bhakti yoga here, not necessarily what Dhritarashtra is doing. He's comparing, you know. We see here, Dhritarashtra achieved success
in this mechanical yoga system by seating himself in the sanctified place, he certainly did concentrate upon the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Hari, you know, the super soul of all existences. So, as he says, all his senses were being engaged in the service of the Lord. So, in this yoga system, if the senses if they're not engaged in the service of the Lord, then they're not used at all.
Then how is it not practical?
What's that?
You said that Nitrasha is not proper is explaining bhakti, and
yeah.
Nitrasha is not achieving bhakti. But here he was using all his engaged senses.
Yes, because we can serve the Lord for liberation. You know,
his aim was not pure.
No, his aim was not to please the Lord, but to attain liberation.
When they say liberation,
what
does it mean? I mean,
you leave the material world.
Does that mean merging into the Brahman?
It can.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm. So, I think Vishwanath Chakravarti at the core describes this as Jnana Mishra Bhakti. One time we discussed, you know, that there's there's Karma Mishra Bhakti, so it's devotional service mixed with Karma, Jnana Mishra Bhakti, Yoga Mishra Bhakti. So this is the process that Madhura is describing is to Dhritarashtra, because he's not qualified fully for bhakti, is how to attain liberation by there's a tinge of bhakti, but you know the goal for Dhritarashtra is liberation, which is a good outcome for him, because you know there are a lot of sinful activities committed for his own, you know, selfish purposes. So he had he would have had to suffer a lot of reactions, a lot of very severe reactions for the amount of suffering that he caused. So for him, liberation, you know, his brother Vidura did not want him to suffer, but he was not capable of coming to the platform of bhakti. So he gave him the next best, which is Jnana Mishra Bhakti. So therefore that's what he's practicing. So in that way, you know, his senses are engaged in the service of the Lord, but not in pure devotional service. And you know, they're still, again, he's fully surrendering to that process of, you know, fixing his mind and senses on the Lord, you know, completely. He's fully surrendered. It means that he's not half-heartedly doing it. He's doing it 100% as this process. He took it, you know, unflinchingly. So that's what it means that, you know, surrendered. He's surrendered himself into the lotus feet of Lord Hari. But although he's surrendering unto himself, you know, it's not pure bhakti, because, you know, there is that mood of his surrendering to attain liberation. But one who does that, they can actually transcend the modes of material nature. Other yogis cannot. So this is, you know, what Prabhupada, you know, we're learning this from Dhritarashtra. If you want to be a yogi, you know, in this type of yoga, you follow Dhritarashtra. You have to fully surrender and fix all your senses on the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the purport, in the same purport, it says the bhakti yoga process therefore directly applies the senses to the loving service of the Lord. So there he is describing bhakti, you know, where you directly serve the Lord with your senses, and that automatically prohibits one from engaging the senses materially. Yes.
Actually, generally, what is the destination of Ashtanga Yogi?
Generally?
What is the destination of Ashtanga Yogi? Because if we have realized the superpower,
then. Well, they'll either attain, you know, very rare, but they can attain liberation, merging.
Impersonal.
Yeah. You know, that full liberation from material existence is very rare, but some of them can. Some of them you know, take birth in this world, you know, as very advanced liberated souls. And some of those who come in contact with devotees may take up devotional service and become devotees, you know, if they get the association of devotees. So, and some, you know, some may. Actually, you know, become Santa Bhaktas in Vaikuntha. Yeah, it's possible that some can actually go to Vaikuntha.
It's Lutra Bhakti.
Yeah, yeah, depending on the degree of bhakti. Little bit of bhakti, enough bhakti, just get them over the Viraj River.
Yeah.
And that little push, and yes, they're in Vaikuntha. Otherwise, you know. Some bhakti, but not enough, is enough to get success in Ashtanga Yoga and attain liberation, but not enough. Yeah. And some of them, you know, will take birth again in the material world, but obviously they'll be, you know, by and large liberated, but they haven't. You know, left the material world, and some of them may, you know, by association with devotees, actually become devotees gradually, bit by bit. You know, there's a bit of variation there with the Ashtanga yogis, because they can go to any planet they like. They can, you know, if they choose to go to Vaikuntha. Or if they choose to go to the Brahman, or if they choose to go to the heavenly planets, generally they can. But according to their attachments, and really, unless they have sufficient association with the devotees, whereby they're really. Attracted, the knowledge and understanding of Vaikuntha and the Supreme Personality of Godhead is developed, where they're attracted to go there, and that their attachment to the Lord is sufficient. You know, their detachment from the material world and attachment to the Supreme Lord is sufficient to, you know, propel them into Vaikuntha. So many yogis may, you know, quite often end up on a heavenly planet, or, you know, and not even, you know, even the liberation is rare. Not to speak of going to Vaikuntha. But the options are generally there for them. We did discuss some of that in the 11th canto of the Srimad Bhagavatam. And in verse 35, of course, we see the you know, The living being, sorry, verse 55. The living being, by his desiring to lord it over the material world and declining to cooperate with the Supreme Lord. Basically, that covers his pure spiritual identity. That desire to lord it over the material world and that declining to cooperate with the Supreme Lord covers his pure spiritual identity. And by the yogic process, when his pure spiritual identity is realized in self-realization, then one has to revert to his original position. So, it's all, you know, one realizes that you know, it's just like if you've, you know, you're walking somewhere and you realize that I've gone in up the wrong road. I should have gone up this road. So you have to walk all the way back and then, you know, go the right direction. So the yogis realize that, you know, I understand that I am a spirit soul different from the body. I'm different from matter. And therefore, because I've been desiring to enjoy matter, identifying with matter, that has covered me to the degree that, you know, that desire is there. So therefore, I have to no longer desire to lord it over the material world, but to get back to my original pure spiritual identity, which is uncovered. So I have to take all the covers off of that. So they're then going in reverse in that mechanical process. That comes to the point where they realize that they're qualitatively non-different from the super soul. And that is the, you know, realization of one's pure spiritual identity. Qualitatively one with it. And you know, in this way they engage in the transcendental loving service of the Lord. That's how they transcend the material sky. And Prabhupada describes it, this is the highest perfection of development of spiritual identity, which was attained by Dhritarashtra by the grace of Vidura and the Lord. Still in verse 55, Prabhupada is describing that a pure devotee of the Lord, so he's describing now, comparing, that a pure devotee, his so-called material body does not exist, being surcharged with the spiritual current of the Lord's identical interest. He is always in the spiritual sky. So, Srila Prabhupada often does this in his purports, that he describes devotional service. He never misses an opportunity to tell us what, you know, pure devotional service is like. And those, even though that description may be, you know, in connection with someone who's not practicing pure devotional service, so sort of as we go through, we need to be able to, you know, distinguish to where Prabhupada is describing pure devotional service, and then when he's referring to exactly what Dhritarashtra or someone else is doing. You know, you see that in the Bhagavad Gita. There are many subjects describing karma yoga or jnana yoga or mixtures and what have you, but Prabhupada was still in those parts describe pure devotional service. And in essence, you know, because that's where, if we follow Srimad Bhagavatam and if we follow Bhagavad Gita, we're going to come to the point of pure devotional service, he's not considering like a separate endeavour. So, you know, in Prabhupada's view, you know, he's this is all the description of pure devotional, is coming to the point of pure devotional service in that sense, you know. So, you know, even what Dhritarashtra is doing here, you know, he could, if he was qualified, from there, you know, move into pure devotional service through the association of Vidura. He wasn't qualified.
Prabhupada, you always keep saying that as it is, we have no qualification, it's only the pure devotees.
Mm.
By their mercy, we become devotees.
Mm.
As such, we have no qualification.
Mm.
But is it then because Dhritarashtra did a lot of sins, he could not do it? Or because that same thing goes for everybody. We are all not qualified. Mm-hmm.
Well,
it's only the mercy that we get from the pure devotees that we get. We start on the bhakti process.
Yeah.
So then, in the association of Vidura, he should have got bhakti. Because he's a pure devotee.
Vidura? Yeah, Vidura is
in the association
of
Vidura. Yeah. He should have got pure bhakti.
There are many people who associate with pure devotees who don't get the benefit. We attain pure devotional service by the grace of Krishna and his devotees. Both. So, if the pure devotees are, you know, giving the opportunity, Krishna may still not allow a person to be elevated, you know, to that position of pure devotional service because of their offences to devotees.
So that's because of the pride.
So we'll come to that a little bit, yeah? Just over the page. We'll come back to that. Srila Prabhupada writes in such a way that we can always glimpse the results of pure devotional service practically in any topic that he's writing about. You know, still in the purport of 56, after complete suspension of the material modes of nature, one is admitted to the spiritual sphere. An action dictated by the spiritual modes is called devotional service or bhakti. Therefore, bhakti is niguna, attained by direct contact with the Absolute. So here, this is one of the things we can learn from that. Srila Prabhupada is describing bhakti as something completely transcendental. It has nothing to do with the material modes. It's coming under the spiritual mode. So then in verse 57 we see how Dhritarashtra is able to attain the perfection of being able to quit his body to go to any planet of a choice. That's what the yogi has, that ability. And Prabhupada says that this is the perfection of the yogi system. You know, the mystic power develops to this point. You know, in one of his lectures, Prabhupada describes, you know, I think it was in Easy Journey to Other Planets, that yogis, they can go from planet to planet as easy as we catch a bus. There's no trouble, you know, just like we think, oh, you know, I'll catch a tram up to Swanson Street. You don't even think twice about it. That for a yogi, that's when they've achieved perfection, that's the stage they come to. The owl would just pop up to the moon, drink a little Swami Rasa, he'll be back in and out. Yeah. Yogis can, you know, even not so long ago, and possibly some still exist, they take bath in four of the sacred rivers, you know, or more, in India, covering a distance of thousands of miles, all within 5 or 10 minutes. And just pop down into the water, you know, northern India, come up the sacred river in southern India, pop back down in the water, come up eastern, about 10 minutes, and just thousands of miles.
Prabhupada has that in one of the purples, isn't it?
What's that?
Prabhupada, I heard that, I'm not sure, in a lecture or somewhere, in, I think we were reading it
recently,
about those boys that appeared out of nowhere in the river.
Yes.
And then Prabhupada said those were probably some yogis.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
You said there's 700 years old. They look like boys.
That's right, yeah. Where was it?
The
Leelamrita.
Then they went to Kumbhaka.
Yeah, that's right.
I remember hearing about it or being somewhere for this reason.
So again, you know, for most people who are practicing yoga, they should understand from this pastime of Dhritarashtra that, you know, here's perfection. You know, you can go to any planet. yes, you're a perfect yogi. Not that by some of the, you know, you can sit there. If people can sit quietly for 15-20 minutes, and their mind is a little peaceful, they feel that they're a perfect yogi because it's so difficult to do. Most people can't sit down, you know, for 5 or 10 minutes and just, you know, they're just mind and the senses. So if they can do that, they think they're really advanced. You know? So Prabhupada's giving some real criteria. And then of course we see that Gandhari, she entered the fire. Very important, because she was obviously a great yogini as well. These days the sati rite, or entering into the fire when the husband has gone, left his body, you know, that action is considered to be very glorious in proper Vedic society. They consider that the separation from their husband is far, far worse than burning in the action, in the fire. And of course that's, you know, being banned in this age by law, and I think also by scripture, you know, that it's not to be done. As the women are not qualified, and one should not force them. They don't have the same attachment, you know, women don't have the same attachment to their husbands. The husbands don't have the same attachment to their wives, you know. The husbands.
Isn't that a material attachment? If you're so attached to the husband.
Well, it depends whether your husband is a great yogi or a devotee. You know. That attachment is good. But, you know, even on a level of piety, it's still good. Even if the husband is, you know, somewhat very elevated, pious person, and after his death he will go to heavenly planets, and the woman, you know, by her pious following her husband, you know, in that way, she will also attain the same destination, the heavenly planet. So whether it be on a material level or a spiritual level, the credit is still there. It's still glorious, but it's not practiced now, because well, you wouldn't want to follow your husband to the next destination these days. You'd probably go to hell. Kali Yuga. But you know, the attachment is not there, and you know, people don't have the ability to perform that level of sacrifice, and they have been. And then finally we see that Vidura was happy to see that his brother attained liberation and become a liberated yogi. And as it describes here, he was sorry. So this does answer the question, as you said, Beshko, that why wasn't Vidura able to turn Dhritarashtra into a pure devotee? Because he was inimical to the Pandavas, who are all devotees of the Lord. Ultimately, the result of such mercy certainly depended on the will of the Supreme Lord in the present life. And therefore, Dhritarashtra attained liberation only. And after many such liberated states of life, one can attain the stage of devotional service. So he merged into the Supreme Brahman. It does mention in the Mahabharata that Queen Kunti also followed Gandhari. It doesn't fully describe, there's not a big description of what happened there, but we understand that she also left this world at that same time. So there's a lot of things there we can learn about how things are done properly. any other comments or realizations here about Dhritarashtra attaining perfection in this yoga process? So we'll just quickly have a look at these verses, some of the important statements regarding Srila Prabhupada's mood and mission from verses 35 to 37, and then there's 47 and 48. So we looked at the first one, verse 35, of course, that one has to be convinced of a better life after renunciation. Otherwise one's not going to be able to stick to it. So we find in our movement that we really try to make a platform of life, a very wholesome, enjoyable life for people, where the renunciation that we encourage them to do is something that they're happy to do, and they're capable of doing, and they can sustain. What are some examples? How we do that? How do we operate in ISKCON in such a way that we help people to maintain their renunciation and stick to it?
There was a case in Sydney when a lady had given her, I think, all her money and everything. And later on, because she had three children, she was a widow. She had no way to sustain them. So then she went to court. And she won the case, and ISKCON had to give it back. Give that money back.
Yeah. How does that? I'm not.
So she had, in the mood of renunciation.
Right. She couldn't.
She gave all the money to ISKCON.
Okay.
She thinking that in the preaching she thought, I have to renunciate, I have to give up everything.
I see.
She has misunderstood or.
And
she gave all the money.
Right.
All her.
So she could.
Land, her house. Everything.
So that they haven't really done a good job there, have they? In helping her to act you know, in a level of renunciation according to her
realization. And she had three children,
yeah,
who were dependent on
yeah,
her.
Yeah.
Yeah. And no husband.
Yeah. So that's an example of what not to do.
Yeah.
So yeah, that's a fact. And examples of what to do. For instance, we ask people to give up meat, which is an impossible task for people. Right? But if we, because we give so much nice prasadam, then we actually create a platform where, you know, as it says here, that you know, they're convinced of a better life after giving up meat. Oh yes, I'll eat prasadam. Oh, I don't mind giving up meat. If they're not convinced that, you know, what they're going to eat every day, they'll not be able to stick to giving up meat. So, you know, in practical ways, our whole movement is really based upon that principle. Where we really are, in every way, you know, we have four regular principles: no illicit sex, no gambling, no intoxication, no meat eating. And, you know, in each case, for a lot of people, that is an impossibility to give up those things. That level of renunciation is just not possible. And somehow or another, you know, the you know, when preaching is done properly, ISKCON, you know, we're able to create a lifestyle for people that they don't miss those things, because their life is just so rich and enjoyable in many other ways. They're quite, and at the same time, that their life, you know, because their life is somewhat enjoyable and a lot more, you know, rich, then they're willing to think clearly. You know, yes, there were a lot of, you know, sufferings associated with the, you know, the intoxication, the illicit sex, the gambling, the meat eating, a lot of suffering associated with it, but I had nothing better. So, you know, if we give them something better, then they're prepared to think and to look at the knowledge and to look at the Bhagavad Gita and then to think, yes, you know, you're correct, you know, I was really suffering, but I, you know, I had nothing better, so I didn't even want to think about it like that. So in that way, that knowledge also, so that's a very big part, you know. But we can't just ask people to give things up, renounce things, without supporting them in that renunciation. So that's an important mission, and, you know, part of our mood and mission. And then we come to the, you know, the cheating principle in verse 37. They felt they'd been cheated. How were they cheated? Why did they feel cheated? Who felt cheated, and why did they feel cheated? Sanjaya, he felt cheated. Why did he feel cheated?
He was thinking
because he was his personal assistant. He didn't know.
They snuck out without telling him.
What I found is that he was feeling he knows Dhritarashtra so well that he would never do that. And what happened is that the Dhritarashtra's consciousness changed by the influence of Vidura, and Sanjaya was obviously not aware of it. And this was obviously something that was more private than Sanjaya was needed to know from Dhritarashtra's side.
Yes.
So
yeah.
He left without telling him about
it. Yeah.
Mentioned him about what?
Thank you.
What's that?
37.
Yeah.
Sanjay never thought that Dhritarashtra could perform any act without consulting him. But Dhritarashtra's going away from home was so confident that it could not be disclosed even to Sanjay.
But why is that so? I'm thinking, like, wouldn't that, if he told this to Sanjay, wouldn't that maybe help Sanjay to also advanced
spiritual. Well, what do you think Sanjay would do when Dhritarashtra is saying I'm leaving?
Call him.
Is that helpful?
Why not?
And if you what's that?
Maybe.
Is that?
Just thinking.
You know, when you've decided to give up all your attachments to everything in the material world, how many people do you take with you on that journey? And what if Sanjay had said, "Don't go," you know? You can do that a little later. What if Sanjay had delayed him for 1 or 2 days? Dura had left. The instructions start to fade a little bit, you know.
Nothing
happened. You know, sometimes when we first get instruction or something, you know, we take it up straight away. We know that we've got a good chance, but we know that a month later we think, I'll just remember what my guru said about doing this, and I'll think about it then. You know, it's gone. It's gone.
Okay.
Forget it. So, I know that's how I thought when I, before I ever met the devotees and I read Bhagavad Gita. I understood, to some degree that ultimately, you have to become detached and attached to, spiritual things. And when I met a devotee and they said, and she come back to the temple, I knew that, well, it's all fresh, I've just read the books and, it's there. If I leave it for a week, a couple of weeks, what you feel like in a couple of weeks' time may be different. You've got a bit of intensity about it, you might as well take advantage because it can just fade, and then, it's so difficult, to get that motivation to do something, to really make a big push, from spiritual life. And Dhritarashtra had it delayed him even a few days, and then, the Dura's instructions fade, that could have been the end. That would have been finished. So Dhritarashtra cheated him. All of them. And Maharaj Yudhisthira, he would have, he would have tried to, prevent him. We see there, in essence, Narada Muni is, in his when he's describing where they've gone, don't bother going there now and trying to bring him back. And why would Yudhisthira, he might think, oh no, I'll bring him back, because he's burned his body. But don't bother going, Yudhisthira. Oh, they'll go get Kandari. Oh, don't bother. And she's also burnt her body. So, Narada Muni was making sure that, Yudhisthira would give up any attempt. So, they had, they had to go, they didn't go straight away. They made a plan, though. They made a plan straight away with Vidura. It may have been, even several weeks, or it may have been even a month or something. I think they went on the next full moon, but. Vidura and Dhritarashtra and Gandhari, they stopped sort of associating, you know, and everyone thought that, oh, Vidura's just given them a little bit more confidential instructions. They didn't really see any of them so much, but they'd actually, you know, and then after a while they thought something, so that all disappeared. So that they actually made a plan from the very beginning how to sort of, you know, first be in the palace, but not quite be seen, and then another time to disappear.
What about Vidura's wife?
What's that?
What about Vidura's wife?
Renounced?
After getting instructed from my family,
yeah.
He came to Hastinapur. He was mentioned he wasn't renounced or like that.
Yeah. Yeah, some stage he renounced. Yeah. He may have. Did he travel as a Vanaprastha?
Was Vanaprastha.
Vanaprastha. He travelled as a Vanaprastha.
Yeah, but
yeah.
When he came back.
Yeah. That's what I thought. Yeah. So he was married, travelled a little bit on pilgrimage, you know, as a Vanaprastha, then renounced all of life.
Kunti Devi was a devotee, whether she was there or she renounced, it's the same, because she was a devotee, pure devotee of the Lord.
Oh, she was a pure devotee, yeah.
So whether she stayed in Hastinapur or she left, it's the same thing. So then why did she leave?
They all left. Vidura was telling them here, he was hinting that Krishna is winding up his pastimes. Krishna is about to leave this planet. Why would you stay? Yeah. Krishna's leaving. You know. It's like Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu says that I have no love. How can I possibly maintain my body, you know, in separation from the Lord? That proves that I have no love, you know. So, to have that association and then knowing that Krishna is leaving, they could not stay. You know, they could not bear that separation. So on this principle here of cheating, that Prabhupada, great souls cheat others for a great cause. It's a nice statement. He gives several examples. But basically he said, because the Lord wanted it, therefore it was a great cause. That's enough to make it a great cause. If the Lord wants it, it's a great cause. And satisfaction of the Lord is the criteria. That's the highest perfection. There's examples there of Sanatana Goswami, Raghunath Das Goswami. And Prabhupada himself. Prabhupada says, we had the same opportunity to cheat the family members and leave home. To engage in the service of Srimad Bhagavatam. Such cheating was necessary for a great cause, and there's no loss for any party in such transcendental fraud. What's that? It's interesting, isn't it? You know, that Vidura also, you know, he was already, you know, he didn't want to take part in the war and the family fighting. You know, already he was thinking like that. The first opportunity, you know, the insult not so much the reason for him leaving, but the fact that, you know, here's the opportunity I want to, you know, get out of here and travel to all the holy places and what have you. So we can see, you know, Srila Prabhupada would have been, you know, chafing at the bit, as they say, you know, it's like a horse ready to bolt. Very dutifully performing his activities, but somehow Krishna gave the opportunity and, you know, he took it. So where's the cheating there with Srila Prabhupada? How do we consider there that Prabhupada is saying that we had that opportunity to cheat? In what way?
He left his family.
What's that?
He left his family.
You think that's the cheating?
Not cheating. In this
context. No, you.
In this context.
Prabhupada? It was cheating that he left his family?
Yeah.
No, they were saying it's for a great cause. But
no, in this context, we're saying that it's okay because it's for a great cause anyway. So great souls are doing it for a great.
Yeah.
In that context.
Yeah. It can be cheating in the sense that one shouldn't leave one's family. I guess that's, you know, cheating.
There were monetary problems at that time.
Yeah. Prabhupada had money problems.
And that's
But I think, you know, we also have to look to the fact that, you know, Prabhupada was probably quite happy to take the opportunity to go and preach as his spiritual master had, you know, ordered him to, and somehow been held back by, for one reason or another, over many, many years. And in one sense, externally, it, you know, it can be cheating in the sense that his real happiness was not revealed. You know what I mean? It's like he's leaving family life. Oh, there's some, you know, major problem, you know, like this. For others, the reason he's leaving the family life is because of the major disturbance and the major discrepancies between, you know, what is sacred and dear to him and his wife. You know, that it, what was most sacred to him just didn't mean anything more than the tea biscuit to her. But the cheating can be in another sense that. That really had very little to do with why he left. You know, the first opportunity. You know, in that sense, you know, it can be cheating. It's sort of, it's there on a couple of different platforms. You know. You know, devotees understand, but from a social platform where Prabhupada was in, no one would really, they would see the external situation as the reason why Prabhupada left the family. That's all. They could not really perceive, you know, to some degree or another, the real confidential reason which was not revealed to others, you know. I mean, you couldn't imagine Prabhupada saying, you know, to his wife or anyway, hey, I'm going to leave the first chance I get and go preaching. You know, he would never say that. He would never reveal that. But nor would he ever do that. You know, Prabhupada, you know, unless the sanction was there by Krishna that yes, I really want it, Prabhupada would stick it out, you know, as a responsible husband and father, if that was, you know, the Krishna's indication. But then for Krishna, you know, to give the signal, oh, I'm calling you to come and preach, he's, you know, very happy about it. It's not cheating in the sense, you know, it's not really cheating in the sense that he's, you know, being irresponsible. Yeah, it's not really that sort of cheating. People may look at it like that. You know, he uses words here like such cheating was necessary for a great cause and there was no loss for any party in such transcendental fraud. You know, there he's calling it fraud. You know, we use fraud when there's, you know, fraud is, you know, almost, you know, like a premeditated attempt to deceive, isn't it? You know, fraud. Yeah. It's quite a... So he's using some very strong words in this regard. Alright. There's a subject there that needs a lot of meditation. In a Raghunath Das Goswami, he cheated the priest, that would be the Brahmin, right? That misled him as to what he was going to do and then took the opportunity to run away. And Sanatana Goswami, well, he lied to a jail keeper, so you probably, you know, you wouldn't consider that such a crime, but, you know, deceiving a priest, you know, he's sort of quite, you know, especially from in their family line, it's quite a terrible thing to do. And in Vedic culture, for someone like Srila Prabhupada to leave his family is, you know, also not so good. I mean, he didn't actually take sannyas. He didn't leave and take sannyas. He left, what age was he? How many years was it before he leaving his family to taking sannyas? He was about 54, that's right, and I think he was about 58 or 59, so it was, you know, 4, 5, 6 years or something later. Yeah. So I guess it was like Vanaprastha, wasn't it? Without travelling with the wife, though. Yeah. So, and just looking at the last couple of verses in that regard, 47 and 48. Again, you know, we see a little discussion here on Prasadam, that these are some of the mission statements of ISKCON, that we teach people not to eat animals and to take Prasadam, and there's no real necessity to kill animals. And of course there was another meaning to this, in that you know, you don't have to worry about Dhritarashtra wanting food, because you know there's sufficient you know, fruits and you know, water and everything, and you know, vegetables available in the jungle that he can accept as a prasad of the Supreme Lord. And then the last verse 48, of course, that
so what is the mood and mission there for you? So the question is mood and mission.
Yeah.
So what is the mood and mission?
All right. You know, the mission, of course, is that you know, to teach people these regulative principles of.
Even if you leave meat, there's still a lot of food to eat.
What's that?
Even if you leave meat and all that, there's still a lot of food to eat. Is that?
Yes. Like, yeah. Well. Yeah. Our mission would be to teach people not to kill animals and eat meat. Mm-hmm. All right. And better that they eat Krishna prasadam. And you know. A lot of this is checked by, you know, awakening their spiritual sense. Yes. And of course, the last one, very important, that we see that what three ways does the Lord rectify the conditioned souls? From within, he corrects as a super soul, and then externally as the spiritual master and as the scriptures. And you know, we should try to cooperate with the Lord and his outward activities for correcting the fallen souls. So, you know, that's our mission, Prabhupada's mission, cooperate with the Lord correcting the fallen conditioned souls. And in this regard, you know, that one should become a spiritual master. And the mood, you see the mood there of taking up that instruction, is that one should become a spiritual master not for personal profit or material gain. So there's a mission that we should take the role of spiritual masters and educate people spiritually to cooperate with the Lord to correct them. But the mood, there's a mood, a proper mood in doing that is to do it with our personal beliefs. Hello. Yeah, can I get you to call back perhaps in about an hour? That'd be great, thank you. Yep. So, you know, also part of the mood there in that verse, the mood of a devotee, is not to be disturbed by the happiness and distress of the world, but, you know, just absorb oneself in sort of activities of executing the mission, you know, which the Lord has descended for. So that's pretty much it for you know, that pretty much covers chapter 13. As described last week, there are the remainder of Srimad Bhagavatam we will cover. And then set an exam on the first week of December. So, you know, there's... some of the, you know, you see some of the verses, some of these, all of the rest of this, sometimes we do a whole unit, five lessons, and we only cover, you know, one chapter or something. The next unit covers all the remaining chapters. Yeah. You know, it's the same, each unit has five lessons. What's that? Got my book here. Yeah, what does it say? From 14 to 19. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Yeah, six chapters. You see, so it sounds like a lot, but you know, all the main points we cover. If you look at the content of the chapters, you see that it's not such a difficult thing. You know, there are many discussions and what have you that don't need to be looked at in depth. We just go through, we'll pick out the main things. So, and the content is not always particularly difficult to comprehend, what have you. So, you know, we'll whiz through this. So all you got to do is, you know, all you got to do is whiz through those six chapters at home, just to read them.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said that we have been exam next week.
Is it next week? Yeah, I think so. Yeah. What have I got in my diary? We could have it today, right? definitely next week on this unit. And then next week we'll actually also start this unit. Yeah. Yes. It only takes an hour to have the test. I mean, I will let people go until they're finished, so, you know, others, but, you know, so we're going to have our 2 o'clock to 5 o'clock session. First hour is the exam. Come in, get it done. If someone needs a little extra time, we can make some arrangements. Then we're just going to continue with the lesson. So, alright, so that's next week. And then, I'll put my diary here. But then, you know, that'll be about 14th. And then there's 21st, 28th. So another 2 lessons, and each of them will have a couple of lessons per week is what we're doing at the moment. We've been doing that pretty well, and then we have an exam, and that's it for this year. So, you know, we are certainly going at a nice pace at the moment, but. You know, a big rest. You have a big rest for a few weeks. You can all sleep in, you know, every day. I'm sure you'll have things to do. Actually, what you can do over the... No, I won't.
So in that exam, December exam, will it include memorizing the slokas?
Well, see... No, not yet.
Not the December
1-2. So we've got an hour now that we can just look over, you know, some of the Pura Svadhyaya questions, you know, anything you need to know, we'll go over that. By the time we finish here, you know, the one thing that we haven't done a lot of recently is, you know, let's say, group activities. We will do more of that next year, but we did sort of hit a slow patch this year. You know, we just sort of really, I think we lost a lot of time unnecessarily. And we mentioned last week, did you hear last week's lecture? Okay. Spent a long time discussing that we've got to be very careful with the questions that we ask, that they're always relevant to the topic, and that in that way, because we can lose sometimes an hour or more in discussing questions. So we discussed that a lot, you know, amongst ourselves last week. We've got to be very careful. Ask questions particularly related to what we know. I know there's so many interesting things, but we've got to be, I think we've had a bit of a learning experience in one sense, and next year we want to just really streamline so that we've got group activities, you know, rather than an hour of questions that are not related, let's have some group activities, keep our questions related, and just, you know, go through at a nice pace and make it a little bit enjoyable. But for this year, I'd really like to at least finish the first canto, and for that we're going to go through at a good pace, but we will have plenty of time. What's that?
Marathon is starting on 22nd of November.
22nd of November, yeah. So what's that? That's we have 2 lessons. What day is that? That's a Monday.
Monday.
Yeah. So we'd have a lesson on what, the 28th.
20th.
So we'd have one more lesson and then the exam. Mm-hmm. Right. So from the time the marathon starts, we just have one lesson in the exam.
Will we have classes after the marathon? During the marathon?
No. We finish on the first week of December. The exam, the final exam for this, which will be Unit 5, is on the first week of December. So that means you really only have one class during the marathon. I think we should, you know, do it in order to finish off. You know, it'd be a very nice way to finish off the year, to finish this. And then next year, you know, from what we've learned, the good and the bad, we'll try and streamline things and do some more group activities. We need to definitely, you know, do more of that.
next year,
mid-January. Yeah.
Mid-January?
Yeah.
I'm coming back
in February. There'll be yourself. I think Padmavati comes back at the end of January.
End of January.
I'm going end of January. You're going. When are you coming back? Again.
First week of March.
Okay. All right. Anyone else? You're back in January.
I'm back in January. So I missed the late class on this.
Right, okay.
When you're leaving, I didn't want Saturday.
You're leaving next Saturday?
Yes. So I have to do this before, because in the afternoon I have to go.
Right, okay. Yep, okay. Yeah, we can do that. Yeah. Alright, so you just missed the last unit.
Yeah.
And you'll be back by the time we start?
Yeah. Okay.
Anyone else? Everyone else is going to be here. So it's not too bad. You know. Okay. So it's important we you all feel confident before any closed book exams, of course, that you know. If you haven't answered any of the homework questions, that when we got the opportunity, just make sure or even if you have answered them, just make sure that you feel that you're confident that you've answered it properly, you know, because that they are half your mark sort of thing. And again, you know, for the essays, just to make sure that you properly understand how to do them. For people who are, you know, away during those times, it's up to you that you can either do the essays or, you know, do them when you get back. At some stage, you know, I've got a list of who's done what and who hasn't. At some stage, people will have to catch up and I would say probably the easiest thing is, you know, if we do have sort of like a mid-break or something sometime during the year, that some of the devotees can catch up on things if they want to, and those things. Otherwise, you know, if there are the odd units that people miss, they can do them right at the end. You know, we can have a, you know.
So in the break, I missed unit one, can I do
that? I'm happy for people to catch up on anything that they've missed, exams or essays, anytime they want. So in other words, if anyone's missed something and they come up to me and say, I am ready now, that I'm keeping up with the work and I want to do this one that I missed, we can arrange that anytime, you know. If it's difficult for you though, then you know we may, and you want it, we can either do it at the end of the whole thing, or you know some of the breaks that we have, you can do it there. But I'm really happy to accommodate anyone who wants to catch up at any time. So let's. Is there anything that from this? Here or any other previous units that anyone wants to ask questions about that I'm not sure about? There.
It's question 14. I didn't have enough time to read properly. It says that we have two reasons, and another said we can't protect others. I understood that one of the reasons is because we are in the jaws of the cobra of time and most snakes. What could be the second one?
Okay, you're saying that you're saying because they're in the jaws of time.
Yeah, basically we can't protect others because we can't be protected. I couldn't figure out.
Yep.
I think that could be one of the answers, but what is the second one? It says two reasons.
Yep. Anyone like to venture that?
Says that every living creature is allowed all protection by order of the Supreme Lord. It's only the Supreme Lord actually who can protect, and Lord is also called Buddha, like one who gives protection to all living. So we cannot protect others, Lord who can.
Yep. So yes. Only the Lord can protect, and you know, in that sense, you know, he's fully controlling. You know, everything is fully controlled by the Lord, as to and no one can supersede that. If someone's trying to protect others, they're also being controlled by the Lord. So you know, they can't protect anyone unless they can only protect one, the Lord will control them in such a way that they can or cannot protect. They have no real independence, right? That's what you're saying. That, you know, because you're saying in the grip of time or in the jaws of time means that everyone is controlled by the Supreme Lord. You know, you know, how can they protect someone from the control of time? They're controlled by time as well. You know, how can you protect someone from time is, you know, controlling them, destroying them, and they're also being controlled and destroyed. So how can they protect? The other point is that you could say only the man in the quality of goodness can help to a certain extent. And Prabhupada makes that point there in verse 46. Firstly, of course, as Prabhupada always says, you've got to know what helping is. So a person in the quality of goodness, at least to some extent, they know what is right. So if anyone, you know, to some extent it can help, it's someone who knows what is good, what is proper, what is needed. So only a man in the mode of goodness. So that's one reason. You know, if they're not in the mode of goodness, they can't protect others. They can't guide them, they can't counsel them, they can't, they have no, they don't even know what the danger is, let alone the remedy, you know, because they're in ignorance. So in one sense and of course the other part there is that they're all they're not free from they also need protection, you know. How can they offer protection to someone when they're also needing the same protection? They can't protect themselves. They can't protect themselves from the pure control of the jaws of tongue. Yeah, it says there's two reasons. It doesn't say the two reasons. You know, so if your reasons are correct, I mean, there's another point here that I got, that the best remedy for getting out of the clutches of, you know, copper like Kala is bhakti yoga. So, we can't protect others. Only one engaged in bhakti yoga can be protected, right? You know, so how can we protect someone? Because only bhakti yoga can give the protection. Anyone who's offering a remedy which is other than bhakti yoga can't give protection. You know, so that's another point. So there may be three or four different reasons there, but at least if you can find two clear ones which are actually there, then that's good.
Yeah.
Could we also say that? Sorry.
Yeah, so the one I mentioned was, is it different from, like one Prabhu said, is that everyone is under control of time.
Yeah.
So how can we protect?
Yeah, they're sort of they are connected, and they're both correct. That, you know, if you say that only the Lord can protect, and similarly we say, you know, only bhakti yoga can give deliverance. It's a similar statement, and then you know another one is that, you know, saying that they're also in the jaws of time, so they can't protect themselves. So they're all, you know, they're sort of connected to a degree, but they're sufficient statements in themselves, you know, to get a good mark there. All right. Any others? Let's have a look. Just to make sure that we've got a proper understanding. What is the process of stabilizing one's renunciation? In verse 26.
On the situation with 25 cents and self-aware soul, you can be like
association. Yeah. Association with saints and self-realized souls. Yeah, that will stabilize one's renunciation. And what are the three classes of transcendentalists?
Dira,
yeah.
Sincere devotee.
Sincere devotee, yeah. And because it gives a little description there of them. It's probably, you know, it's important to also understand, you know, how we identify each of those three. And of course, a little further information, how do we explain the difference between a dhīra and a naratam in verses 28 and 30? Does it say 28 and 30 or 28 and 31? Yeah, I think it's 30, personally. The difference between a dhīra and a naratam.
Dhīra leaves home for good without communicating with
the. So he's saying, this is from purport to 28, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Or sorry. Okay. Yeah. So you're saying a dhīra is someone who leaves home. What was the rest of that?
No.
For good.
Communicate.
For good.
Not disturbed by family association.
In
28 it says Narottam is first class human being who is completely dependent on Supreme Lord.
Yep. Those things are there. Probably, you know, important points is that the dhīra is a preparatory stage of sannyas.
Mm-hmm.
And the sannyas is the naratam.
Okay.
I think that's an important part of the understanding at first. You see that in the purport to verse 28. Just come up and see me if you need me, all right? I'll be finished in about 10 minutes. So then a little further distinction. We see in verse 30 it says Maharaj Dhritarashtra accepted the order of Vanaprastha. in verse 30 there, in the purport. He says, Vaishnava sannyasis are Narottams, whereas Mayavad sannyasis are Deeras. That's sort of a secondary point, really. But so really, Dhritarashtra became a Deera. He accepted Vanaprastha. Narottam is one who completely depends upon the Supreme Lord, and they can take sannyas. Their dependency on the Lord and renunciation is more complete. What's that?
Paramahamsa?
No, not Paramahamsa. There are four orders of Paramahamsa, four orders of sannyas, of which Paramahamsa is the fourth order of sannyas. So not all sannyasis are Paramahamsas. In this context, we would say that a deer is vanaprastha and a narottam is sannyas, and that for further clarification is that the narottam, is on a higher level because they completely depend upon the Supreme Lord. Yes.
Yeah.
But, the deeras are in the preparatory stage of coming to that point of complete dependence on the Lord, but they can't fully do it yet. They can't fully do it because they're not completely relieved of all taints of sins, whereas the Narottam is.
There are no other with our sannyasis, is there, are they going through that stage, like one danda and then three danda, or?
No.
They
keep the same danda, but. I know one god or three gods here, no.
The other day I heard somebody, some was explaining me, like, of that sannyasi, he has three danda. The other ones, they have only one
done. Really? the other ones, yeah.
Yeah.
The other ones are not.
Never heard of them before.
The other ones are in a different movement, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're not in this movement.
I didn't really understand how this came.
All our sannyasis are three dunder, three rods.
Actually, they have three rods?
Yes, they're in there. They're all in the encounter. And there's a little one on the top that represents the jiva. Yeah, so little one at the top, and then you've got the three.
Three down. Never saw that before.
Yeah.
It's always covered,
that these days, because they travel, they have it covered. Why did Maharaj Yudhisthira consider himself ungrateful? What did you say?
Dhritarashtra was giving them protection when they were children, so he was thinking about the positive things Dhritarashtra did for them.
Yeah. They gave them all royal facilities to live. Yeah.
And then he said, and now we gave him back nothing.
Because,
like,
well, he
glorifying the positive deeds and not thinking about.
He did more than that. What did Maharaj Yudhisthira do after receiving all his royal facilities?
Kept him dead.
He had all his sons killed.
Oh yeah.
So, this is why he was thinking himself ungrateful. Is it? And so that's there. And you know, I think it's probably important to add that he thought like that because a devotee, as it describes here, they never find fault with others, but they try to find their own faults and rectify them as far as possible. I think that's, you know, quite an important reason why he felt ungrateful, because it's the whole, you know, mentality of a devotee, not fault finding and looking for their own faults. And therefore, he didn't see the faults of Dhritarashtra, but he saw his own. And what were those faults? They were as we described. Yeah. So I think to leave out that part is probably not good.
I find this principle of not looking for other faults, looking for your and disclosing your faults, bit
disclosing?
Troublesome in business life. Like, if you don't want to put others into trouble by saying, like, you know, that guy did this, that guy did that. But, you know, I also do mistakes. That I found that attitude is basically negative in a business sense. When you're working in the environment, then they will say, look, somehow you portray a person who is full of faults, but nobody else has faults.
Hmm. You have to be careful that if you allow people to criticize you as a devotee, it's harmful for their spiritual life.
Prabhupada mentions in Bhagavad Gita and the material modes, it is okay for a Vaishya to lie. He can even do black magic. Prabhupada says in the book in 1805 or something, it's okay for a Vaishya when you do business. It's okay. This and that material thing, you can lie.
You
can even engage in black market.
So,
so basically, we should not allow others to criticize us, isn't it?
Well,
I mean, you shouldn't disclose your troubles.
Well, one generally. Non-devotees cannot understand a devotee and why they do things, and so they will see fault where there's no fault, and then if you try and explain it, they can't understand it anyway, so it's better not to even bring the subject up. But it's not good for them to criticize, because one should never criticize a superior person, you know, one should. You know, it doesn't help them. You know, even if you've actually done something wrong, it's better that you know, they just only have a favourable attitude towards you. You know, you're better off to actually not mention it. You know, even if you made some boo-boos or some mistakes and what have you. You know, the more you know, they respect you and like you and you know, are aware of good qualities and what have you, the better it is for them. They're not really on the platform where they can deal with the faults of a Vaishnava, so it's better not to really, you know, bring them to that level of thinking in those terms. And things that they consider faults are not really faults in them. You know, it's in the same principle of transcendental fraud, in one sense. You know, Prabhupada was once approached by one of his disciples who asked permission to leave his wife, divorce her. They were, you know, couldn't live together, having a lot of difficulties. Marriage was on the rocks completely, but still, you know, the Vedic process is you remain married and you just work through it, you know, through thick or thin, you know, to the very end. That's, you know, that's proper. But come what may, you just stick it out. You know, no matter how much you're suffering, you know, you just stick it out. So anyway, Prabhupada, he wanted to leave his wife, and then he was going to later marry another woman. And Prabhupada gave him permission. And his servants come in to Prabhupada after the person left the room. He said, Prabhupada, you know, I find it very difficult to understand, you know, because you've always preached how, there's no divorce and we should not do it, and then you've given permission. Prabhupada said he was going to do it anyway. Whether I gave permission or not, he was going to do that. But by doing it with my permission, the offence to the Guru is far less. So he was going to do it anyway. He's going to leave his wife, marry this other woman, no matter what Prabhupada said. And that would have been a huge apparad, you know. And Prabhupada, so you see, Prabhupada put him in a position where he did not develop an offensive, critical, or even disobedient activity or mentality to his spiritual master. He saved him from offense. So, you know, it's not good for Vaishnavas to put themselves in a position where people unnecessarily criticize them, even if there's some faults. So amongst Vaishnavas, we're happy to hear from other devotees, you know, constructive criticism, how we can improve. But amongst non-devotees, that principle doesn't always hold. You need to be careful. The same with children, you know. Parents don't always, you know, come home and tell the children all the things that went wrong that day, you know, all the things that they did wrong. It's also not good for, you know, we only tell children a certain amount so that they've always got this conception of security and happiness and respect. So we let them know, you know, what the parents are doing to that degree. Everything else that might shake their little world up, we don't tell them. It doesn't do them any good, you know, for the sake of honesty and truth. You know, there are many things that you can't tell a child, even if they sometimes inquire. And you have to actually, you know, just tell them. Sometimes it's a little white lie, or just, you know, divert their attention and wait for many years until they become a little older, and then you can actually reveal to them, you know, certain facts that you may be aware of that you didn't tell them. So, you know, non-devotees are like, spiritually, they're like children, little babies. You know, little children, very immature, and that's how you, in one sense, you treat them like that. In what three ways does the Lord rectify the conditioned souls? We we discussed that from within as a
Paramatma,
yeah. Yep. Very good. And why wasn't Vidura able to turn Dhritarashtra into a pure devotee? We looked at that, right? Because of the offences, yeah, to the Pandavas. And we can see that it also depends upon the will of the Lord. You know, even though Vidura is a pure devotee, we can see that, you know, the will of the Lord is still a factor there. Now, generally, you know, the Lord does not consider high or low. He doesn't consider that this person is sinful and this person is pious. This person is a demon and this person, you know, he doesn't consider on that platform. Never makes that distinction. We make those distinctions. You know, we put ourselves in those places. He sees us all as spirit souls, and he's happy for each and every one of them, the most sinful, even, you know, the pious, everyone, they can take up devotional service should they wish to do. But if one is offensive to the devotees, for that reason, he will make a distinction and not give the opportunity for that person. That's how serious. So you can be, you know, extremely sinful person, and the Lord will not distinguish you from a very pious person, and not make a distinction. You know, the opportunity is there for both. If they want to, you know, surrender to the Lord and take up devotional service, then he will give them both equal opportunity. Yes, both come. But if one is offensive, you know, commits Vaishnava aparad, then he says no, not that. Yeah, therefore, you know, you see in our movement that sometimes you see people who come along for many, many years and they're engaged in intoxication, and they, you know, they have, they gamble, some of them eat meat, some of them, you know, they do all sorts of things. Some of them, and somehow or another, they get to do, you know, a lot of service and associate and what have you. Because they're not offensive, and they can go like that for many years. You know, they, of course, if they give up their sinful activities, they can make more serious advancement. But the Lord actually allows them to come to the temple year after year and associate and go into the temple, go to all the festivals. But even a senior devotee, as soon as they become a Vaishnava aparad, their situation is very dangerous. They can be removed by Krishna within a very short time. Yeah, so, you know, therefore, Dhritarashtra was guilty there. Why is Devi Rishi Narada described here as Bhagavan?
Is being the most confidential devotee of the Lord.
Yep.
Treated on the same level.
Yes, yes. Treated on. Yep. If one is the most confidential devotee of the Lord, then they're treated on the same level as the Lord Bhagavan. Yep. So they're very dear to the Lord because they're very dear to other devotees. Yeah. So, you know, both of them are treating them on the same level. List reason why Gandhari is considered an ideal woman.
She was following her husband in all situations.
he was blind, so she was keeping him blind for all her life.
Sorry, what was that?
Basically, she was very faithful in supporting her husband throughout all the tribulations. And basically, like, example
yep.
is he was blind, so she was keeping a blindfold.
Right, so she was an ideal woman as a wife,
yeah.
Yeah, and a mother. And anything else? And an ascetic, yes. Never disturbed by all kinds of suffering. Yep. So that may, and she's described as a typical example of an ascetic, you know. Marvelous character in trying situations. So it's an ideal, three reasons there. Is ideal as a woman, as a mother, wife, and ascetic. Mm. Very rarely found such character. What analogy does Narada use to pacify Maharaj Yudhisthira in verse 43? So this has got two parts. The first part is very really just from the translation. As a player sets up and disperses his playthings according to his own sweet will, so the supreme will of the Lord brings men together and separates them. Now, why is that example very suitable? You know, the example of a player. Why is the example of a player very suitable?
Because the player is the one who controls the playing. Basically, I understood it. I just summed it up. We are not controllers. Because if we are the playthings, we can't really control what will happen.
So well, here the player is referred to as the Supreme Lord.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we are the playthings.
Okay. So.
That is all his will, not really have the possibility to help others.
Yes, it is. It's all his will. He's fully independent. He's not bound by, you know, the laws of karma, or not bound by any law or the law of karma. It says that the law of karma is that one is awarded the result of one's own actions, but in special cases, by the will of the Lord, such result and actions are changed. But this change can be affected by the will of the Lord only and no other. Therefore, the example of the player cited is quite appropriate. We discussed a little bit about astrology last week in relationship to devotees, and you see it's the same principle here. By the will of the Lord, you know, if he likes, he can adjust one's karma as he pleases. It's not necessarily, you know, so in that sense it's appropriate. It's not to be taken in the sense that, you know, I guess, you know, when you say we play things in the hands of the Lord, it almost gives you the connotation of someone who's whimsically, without any reason or rhyme or reason, moving people around, and, you know, will send a type, you know what I mean? It's, I guess in one sense, when you say play things in the hands of the Lord, got to be careful that we really specify that. Prabhupada says here, says these changes of result and actions are especially rendered by the Lord when a pure devotee is involved. Especially. he qualifies it. For the Supreme Will is absolute, free to do whatever he likes, and because he is all perfect, there is no mistake in any of his actions and reactions. So the important point there is that, you know, he can control everyone and everything by his own supreme will, and he's not dependent upon any other law. That's the important point of it. That's how the analogy is intended to be taken, that he's in that way, he's like a player. And therefore Prabhupada qualifies that by saying that because he's all perfect, you know, just to make it that it's not to be taken in the sense that, you know, we're playthings in the hands of the Lord according to his whims, and, you know, he'll just do things, you know, for any old reason. Got to be careful that analogy is not taken the wrong way. You know, you can, if you quote that to someone, in the sense, you know, people can get a really bad, you know, conception of the Lord if you say, oh, we're all playthings in the hands of the Lord. I read that in Srimad Bhagavatam. People can actually take offense at the Lord.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. That's why the question is there. Just make sure we have a proper understanding how to apply it. We did the next one, 14. And, what's that? That's pretty much it. Have we missed anything?
What's the third one? Why was Yamaraj anxious to appear in the second?
That's probably in the previous lesson. What was it?
Three. Verse 15.
Why was Yamaraj anxious to appear as Vidura? Oh, yeah, we discussed that one. We discussed 1-5 last week. But the answer that, you know, is there in verse 15 is that because he's a Mahajan, he had a desire to preach. You know, it's his duty to preach, and he had a desire to preach. When this one here becomes 5, and there's 2 zeros.
I'll take it.
Let's
finish. Okay. I'll tell you when it's
5 o'clock. Yep. So everyone's pretty happy with you know, all their questions and their essays and everything up to this point. Everyone's pretty clear. Yeah. I hope you are, because we got the exam on Saturday. Everything alright? Okay then. And, 2 o'clock. Do you want to start early? Okay. I'll see you after class. Alright then, we'll see you next Saturday, not before. Any other questions?
What about the last exam?